Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dose Nation. I'm your host, Jake Kettle. Thank you for joining us. I hope everybody is having a restful week. I hope everybody is having a good week. I hope everybody is enjoying the little bit of good weather that we've been getting lately, at least if you're on the East Coast. Finally, the snow has stopped to a degree, and the rain has begun, but with the rain has come the sun, so we're very happy about that. But and I'm also very happy about today's show, and of course, with me, as always, is the co-host of Dose Nation podcast, and that is Brian Norman. Brian, how are you?
I am well. I'm happy. I saw some crocus pop out of the ground today. I've been waiting.
Yep.
It's been very cold. It's been a cold spring out here in Amherst.
A funny anecdote. I actually, I never knew why, but when I was a child, I used to go out into the yard, and every time the first crocuses that would come up, I would always pick three of them, and I would give them to my mother as a gift. And this is now 20 years, you know, almost, if not more later, that I'm still picking flowers for my mother in the beginning of spring.
So that's very nice of you.
It's just kind of a tradition, you know. It's those first flowers that give you that sign of the warmth is coming, you know.
Oh yeah, they're like little magic colors popping out of the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but let's introduce today's guest. Many of you know him, and many longtime Dose Nation listeners will remember our first interview with ethnomusicologist Alexandra Tanous. And I would encourage everybody right now to go over to soundmeditation.com. That's www.soundmeditation.com. Bookmark that page and keep it. Hold on to it for dear life, because there is so much information there. So much useful information that it's unbelievable. Alexandre is going to be speaking at a symposium this year as well. So, Alexandre, how are you? It's great to have you back on.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and great to be on the show again.
Yeah, it's been a while, but it's great to have you back on. I think you were actually one of our very first guests, believe it or not. So
he was one of the first guests when I had first started listening, and it was one of the podcasts that caught my attention.
We've gotten a lot of positive feedback. So you know, but let's start off. So you're going to be at Symposium this year, and you're going to be giving a speech up there. Now I don't know all the details on that, but maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview of what you're going to be talking about.
Sure. Yes, I will be at Symposium next weekend, the 12th and the 13th, and I'm very much looking forward to. I was invited to come and talk about sound research, the sound research I've been doing for the past 7 years. I'm an ethnomusicologist, composer, musician by training. And about 7 years ago, I started this independent research on the esoteric and therapeutic properties of sound, looking at sound from three different perspectives: the shamanic societal beliefs, the Eastern philosophical and holistic practices, and also through Western scientific research, which is basically, what do we know about sound through acoustics, which is a branch in physics that studies sound behavior, how it modifies neurochemistry and the brainwave cycles, and so on and so forth. So I'll be talking about a lot of fascinating things that I think everyone would be interested in hearing, because everyone loves music. And of course, this is about sound. So it's going to demystify a lot of things. Unfortunately, I won't be able to go into all the details that I'd love to give everyone during the presentation, but it would be a great dose for everyone. And also, I'll be giving sound meditation as well.
So, can you talk a little bit about the idea of sound meditation? One of the most popular pictures of you online is actually of you standing around these giant bowls, and you're using these I don't know what they are. They're like tongs or something, you're making these kind of meditational sounds, it looks like. So what is sound meditation, really?
Sound meditation is an integrated practice that I put together based on my life experience with meditation, various forms of meditations that I started practicing since age 14. And my studies in music, which lasted for many years. I've done 12 years also of higher education, done 4 degrees in music. And also my interest in shamanism. Mm-hmm. So the sound meditation is an integrated practice that amalgamates mindset or intentions, setting, meditation, breathing exercises, visualization, and guided visualization, and verbal guidance to bring awareness, toning and vocalization, working with overtone emitting instruments, and applying, and this is very important, applying judicious, attentive, and equanimous listening. We don't always listen in the same way, and we all know that there's a difference between listening and hearing. But the more aware of how we listen to music or sound that we're listening to, the more we get out of it. And basically, it's a way of tuning out of the habitual patterns of the mind, the discursive thinking, and really being present to anything that we're listening to.
So it's this idea of being present to that in that moment, to that sound.
Exactly. Yeah. This sprung out of a field that is normally called sound healing. Mm-hmm. In sound healing, you know, you have the practitioner playing certain type of instruments. But I think I personally don't like the term sound healing because it's assuming. And as we all know, healing is a word that has been way misused and overused, and especially in the past 10 years. So I don't splurge with the term. I don't use it casually and so freely, and I respect it so much. That's why I don't really call it sound healing. Plus also, you know, I have a lot to say about what heals in sound, whether, you know, any performance or any practice on these instruments would be healing or not. Not really. It depends on the intention, depends on the setting, it depends on how we're listening, depends on what kind of instruments the practitioner is playing. But if there's any healing, it's on the receiver's end, and it's not on the practitioner. A practitioner does not heal people with sound. The practitioner gives people an opportunity to be healed, but that is also something that's very complex. When I work with people, I don't heal them with sound. I constructed the sound meditation and I called it so because of the complexity of the medium, and because there's a lot to know on the receiver's end to how to do things and how to observe things to create any healing. And they would be responsible for it. There is no magic.
So really it's sort of the idea that, you know, seek and you shall find, you know, if you attune yourself to it,
exactly.
If you can put yourself into that moment, and if you can use it for, you know, in the correct frame, you know, frame of reference, the practitioner's, you know, meditational guidance will be healing or will be of use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's because of the, but really the burden is on the, is on the receiver, is on the one who's trying
on the
to
receiver,
be healed.
But also
yeah.
The practitioner should know a lot, mm-hmm. a lot of information, a lot of things about sound. And unfortunately, I don't see this happening from, you know, the literature that I've been exposed to during the research, and also all the studies that I've done. There's so much to know about sound, and I'm not saying that, oh, it's easy to learn everything. No, there's a lot of research that one should consider. Maybe we can talk about them later on. And most importantly, to observe how other ancient musical cultures have used sound, and what kind of sound, what kind of musical mathematical ratios they've dealt with, what kind of attention they gave to ethos, what kind of modes or scales they've used, what kind of instruments they've used, and what kind of settings they've created for sound healing to be effective, so on and so forth. So there's really a lot. And it's not just a matter of doing 3 or 6 month long workshop or study and getting a certificate that, you know, okay, you're a sound healer, go and heal people. It's right. Not like that.
Right. It's kind of like the Michael Harner become a shaman, buy my kit, you know, with the drum and the rattle and, yes, you know, in the book, and you can become an Amazonian shaman overnight. All right. You know, No, that's not how it works in reality.
I buy shamanism.
Yeah, exactly. Mail order shamanism, you know?
Yeah. It's, and to be honest with you, this research has exposed me to the most important things about sound for all the things that I've studied in the past since I was a kid till now. And then, even in the 12 years of training at university, everything I learned I view now as to be superfluous compared to the things that I've been discovering. And that is why I've been so excited sharing this with people and giving it to people, because that's not stuff that you can study about even in respectable institutions and universities, or having been serious musician, composer, or
right,
musicologist, ethnomusicologist, and any serious academic or practitioner.
So are there any frequencies, or, you know, because again, we're talking about meditation, so there are things that resonate with people in meditation. Yeah. Like, you know, with like in the Coptic tradition, they meditate and they say the Jesus prayer, or in the Eastern traditions, they meditate and they repeat a mantra over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Are there certain sounds and vibrations and frequencies that interact with the human mind in a certain way, you know, that can sort of guide these meditational sessions in towards one way or another, or is that again up to the individual person as to what what frequency resonates with them, or what sound resonates with them?
Mm-hmm. So far, we don't know what specific frequencies target what specific parts of the brain or specific ailments or issues.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any scientific proof of that. But what we know, and this is something also that I've done a lot of scientific studies on, especially with brainwave cycles. I've done a lot of EEG studies. EEG is electroencephalography, which is basically measuring the level of electrical activities that are happening in the brain. And we all know that the brain is basically a place where a lot of activities on the electrical and chemical levels happen, and they cause specific parts of the brain to be active, and it's really, really complex mechanism. So we're not gonna try to delve into the deepest detail on this. But what we know that's very effective is that sound, and specifically certain type of sound, can induce deep meditative states.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound that I work with is overtones. So basically overtone emitting instruments. And these instruments have been used in sound healing for centuries, and they're still used right now in this field. Basically, gongs, Tibetan bowls, tuning forks, discs, bells,
right,
didgeridoo, mm-hmm, overtone singing or diaphonic singing. These are far more effective sound sources than normal instruments. Although overtones are found everywhere in any sound that we hear, whether human voice or sound in things in nature, wind and birds and animals, or all human-made instruments. But the value here is working with instruments that have a pronounced overtone set, in, such as the instruments I stated before.
Now, how about something like polyphony, right, where you have those layers of singing? How is there any benefit to sound meditation in polyphonic chant or anything like that?
Yeah. They can certainly be helpful, and they can induce altered states of consciousness, meditative states. Depends on what kind of polyphony. So this is a general term for those of you who are not familiar with the word.
Sorry, I should have given background.
That's okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. So basically, polyphony is one of the four textures. Most people think that there are just three textures. Let's start with the simplest one. Homophony is when, let's say, the three of us are singing or playing the same tune without any variation. This is basically how people sing Happy Birthday, yeah, without any fancy harmonization.
Right.
And then you have homophony. Homophony is when you have a principal melody and accompanying chordal patterns or accompanying harmony. So when you have a melody, let's say, Jake, you're playing guitar and singing. Your voice is the principal melody and the chords that you're playing on the guitar are the supportive harmonies. So that would be homophony. Polyphony is when the three of us are playing or singing three different melodic lines, and each one is as important as the other. Mm-hmm. And because they form specific complex texture. For example, Bach, if you listen to Bach or most musical styles from the Baroque period, Vivaldi, Handel, so on, these are polyphonic styles. The fourth texture, which most people are not familiar with, is heterophony. Mm-hmm. Heterophony is, let's say, when the three of us are playing the same melody and each person is doing different ornamentation on that basic melody. So the principal part is the same, but we're all giving different interpretations, different ornamentations to, you know, create certain individuality. And all four textures can be applied also to rhythm, not only melody. So you can also have monorhythmic texture, homorhythmic, polyrhythmic, and heterorhythmic.
And one of the people that really worked with this that I thought was fascinating and that I wanted to mention in the show, and maybe you could talk a little bit about him, is Guillaume de Machaut.
Yes.
The 13th century composer, which is before Baroque, but what period would you consider that? Medieval, I suppose?
This is medieval.
Yeah.
Medieval period ended around 1420 in Western Europe. And then the Renaissance started from 1420 to 1600. Baroque 16 to 750, 1750 and so on. So Guillaume de Machaut was influential because he was one of the first serious composers to have started experimenting with polyphony. And that is constructing compositions where various musical lines are weaved together and the melody interweaves and you can find the melody in this thick, opaque, and rich texture that you'll be hearing. And he influenced a lot another composer that came after him, Palestrina, and Palestrina influenced Bach and Handel and Vivaldi and so on. So when you deal with such texture, you kind of, and the listener is present, the listener is overwhelmed in a very beautiful and effective way that if they know how to listen to these textures, to these lines, and pay attention to the melody, pay attention to the parts, and not to their thoughts on what they're listening to, then they're able to delve into an altered state of consciousness. Basically, they're making the meditation far more effective than normal. Why? Because they're using a tool, and that tool is a sound.
Yeah, and what I find fascinating is that when you listen to something like the Messe, and I'm going to probably mispronounce this, so you correct me if I do, Messe de Notre Dame, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Messe de Notre Dame?
Yeah. Guillaume de Machaut's Mass there's a particular intro it, which has a polyphony to it that when you hear it, and I wish I could pull it up and play it, but I don't have it up right now. That when you hear it, it just gives you this unbelievable sense of you're being engulfed by this music because there are all these different tones and notes and sounds coming at you at the same time, and I really had not found very much of that prior to him, prior to Machaut. I mean, he really seems to be the one who took that idea of polyphony and harmony and, you know, getting all these voices together and pushed it into that, into the mainstream musical scene.
Yes, yeah. So a little word about how the style developed. This is also important for the audience to know.
What year are we?
1340s?
Yes.
Okay.
So harmony started in Notre Dame Cathedral, which is still found now in Paris. It's a very famous cathedral, around the 11th century, with primarily two composers who were also monks, Léonin and Perrotin. Mm-hmm. Before that, people did not really, in Europe that is, did not explore sophisticated harmony. The only thing that was around, which is basically a drone, playing a drone and singing or playing a melody over that.
Like the Eulalian pipes or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me, I'm suffering from allergies today. So Léonin and Perrotin started adding notes to pre-composed melody or melodies that they've composed, and realized that there are points of consonance agreements, euphonic points that enriched the melody. And little by little over the centuries, these notes became more and more elaborate. They added more notes and so on. I mean, Léonin and Perrotin started it and took it to certain depths, but other composers continued this trait. So harmony is really a fairly recent practice. Harmony is one of the last characteristics of music to have been developed, and it's a Western thing. In other more ancient musical cultures, of course, you find harmony, but it's not the Western harmony that we know. And harmonies, for example, used in Indian classical music, mm-hmm. Turkish, Arabic, Persian, or African, or so on, they're really, really basic that we don't even consider them harmonies. But this is exactly the harmony that we should be looking into, because it's more faithful to the harmonic series, more faithful to the support that we need to give just the right amount of harmonic support and not to detract attention from other important characteristics in music, complexity of the melody, the rhythm, the tone, color, another very important thing, because this is where overtones are. And this is why other musical cultures did not develop harmony like we know in the West, you know, playing chords and playing what's called tertial harmony. That means you construct harmonies based on adding thirds. Major chord or minor chord, diminished or augmented, is when you have a root, let's say that root is a C, and then you add to it a third. So C, you skip the D, go to an E, that's your third. And the fifth, skip the F, go to the G. So you need root, third, and fifth to construct the most basic chord, whether that be major, minor, augmented, or diminished chords. If you want to add more, then you continue adding thirds to get 7th, 9th, 11th, and 13th, which are used in sophisticated classical music or jazz, especially rarely rock music. I'm talking about the 9th, 11th, and 13th. 7th chords are common in blues and in rock music. So this is tertial harmony. This is a really dense, opaque, sophisticated harmony, but it's more like an academic way of exploring harmony. And it's beautiful, but it's not mind-altering as much as the more basic harmony that we find in more ancient musical cultures. When you start studying these musical cultures, you will find that harmony is absent. And that became a problem for many people, because as Westerners, we started thinking, oh, they're still in their primitive development, musical development, because their harmony did not develop. And, you know, we by thinking like that and writing about this and communicating this to the natives, we cause them to have a complex of inferiority. And this is a major problem throughout the Middle East, for example, in Arabic musical culture, which is an ancient musical culture, and Turkish and Persian and also Indian, that they started doing their best to force harmony to be included. And very often you cannot really harmonize it because the music that they're playing is often microtonal, which mm-hmm. includes quarter tones, which are not found in Western scales. So you cannot harmonize microtonal music with chords, normal Western chords. The only time you can do it is when you construct fusion or modern music influenced by the West. And of course, that would dilute the musical culture. And this is a major problem because Western music is affecting so much ancient traditional music, and all young people are interested in Western music, of course, pop, rock.
What bands or what musicians now do you think are doing it right, I guess?
In the West?
Yeah.
Well, it's a hard question to ask. You mean doing amalgamating musical cultures and doing correct fusion?
Right.
Well, this is a whole topic. I mean, I can talk about this for hours, but I don't want to name bands, but I can tell you what would be the characteristics of good workable fusion, because fusion can easily become confusion. And it's not just a matter of mixing whatever, you know, we think should be there, a little bit of African, a little bit of South American, a little bit of Indian and flamenco and jazz, and there we go. No, it's a lot more tricky than that, because once you start combining different musical cultures in one medium, certain ones become risked of being neutralized. So if you're trying to amalgamate different musical cultures together, you have to do it with utmost care and respect to the characteristics of that specific musical culture. You have to watch that this neutralization not to happen, and use taste and not to force the music to make to sound Western. Force harmony, especially, to be part of this fusion that you're constructing. To do it with great awareness and knowledge of what the original music, the traditional music, should sound like. What is the richness? What do people focus on when they're listening to the traditional music? What are the aspects that should be kept around in that new piece that you're amalgamating? There are many bands that are doing it very well, and some are doing it, you know, with lesser level of awareness. Of course, people don't have the intention to butcher the music, but, you know, when we don't know enough, miracles happen, and often, you know, the result is not so satisfactory.
So, as far as, now, before we go back again into history and talk about some more chants and things like that, I want to talk a little bit about electronic music and electronic dance music and this scene that is rapidly emerging and that is gaining huge amounts of traction, almost to the point where it's beginning to phase out bands.
Yeah,
in my personal opinion is that I'm seeing a phasing out of bands, and a rise of electronic artists, of electronic producers. Mm-hmm. Is there now? What is it with electronic dance music that draws people so closely to it? You know, there has to be something in the music. I feel like, it can't just be, well, you know, commercialization, because most of these guys are just, you know, normal guys sitting behind a computer in their house, yeah, you know, pushing on buttons. So it's not like they have the backing of, you know, of Disney or any, or, you know, like a Miley Cyrus type would, or someone like that. So.
Mm. Yes. Well, why is it popular, and what's in it that's infatuating? Well, there's a lot that I can talk about here. Why is it popular? Well, for many reasons. First, because you have great producers and DJs, and they're able to reach wide range of different audiences, mostly younger people, although not only young people listen to electronic music. Remember that electronic music started a long time ago.
Oh, yes.
Only in the last 10, 15 years that started to become really, really big, and mostly in the alternative community. And basically, electronic music can be difficult to compose, but not all the time. Yes, any one person can produce a great CD or great track at home alone. And that is affecting bands. And, you know, that shouldn't happen, actually. Both should continue to exist. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot to say about bands because of the complex dynamics and the different levels of musicianship and opinions in
personal style.
Personal style, and also musicians affecting each other. And, you know, bands are not just people who just come together to record or just to play a gig. Very often they're very close friends, and there are very complex dynamics between them. So they affect each other a lot. It's like a small group of thinkers who are creating at the same time and negotiating very difficult things. And often, you know, people know how frequently band break up and come back together, or they change format, or one guy leaves and they get another guy to replace, you know. So there are a lot of complex dynamics that are part of any human dynamics. So it's important to keep this going, because that is great craftsmanship in the art of making music. But also one or two or bunch of people can get together and construct an electronic track or recording. though the process is very different. And now, what kind of level of musicianship is required? Well, very often DJs are trained in music. They're educated. They know a lot of music. They don't need to know, though, to be able to compose an electronic track, because as people know right now, practically any person can sit down and figure out something on GarageBand or on any software and create the electronic track. It's just a matter of having a taste, because you have various presets, and all you need to do is just select this to go with that, to go with this, to go with something else. And next thing you have beautiful texture with various breaks and rhythms and fluctuation of or changes in tempo and tone color. So a non-musician can do this. And this is also wonderful, because it opened up the field to many non-trained musicians to be able to do this for fun or, you know, more seriously. But for the most part, you know, there are certain aspects in electronic music that affect humans, especially if the receivers are dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is also another thing that we can talk a lot about, is how easy it is to make music popular, music that would appeal to a large mass of people, especially when it's for partying.
Right.
You know, Western Europeans and North Americans, you know, Westerners, let's say in general, like a lot to party.
And, oh, yes.
And unfortunately, music in the West is often limited to partying, to dancing, to the commercial aspect, to the mainstream. Whereas when you start to study other musical culture, you realize that this is just one aspect. There's the religious, the spiritual, the transcendental aspect of music that are not fully explored in the West, you know, with the exception of religious. That's something that is explored.
Which we'll get back to later in the podcast.
Exactly. So we shouldn't really focus only on music as means to just dance and see music only as something to be plugged in just to make us move. And we'll be missing out a lot.
But a lot of people see it that way, though. I think in you know, when it comes to being in the pit, you know, of like of a Bass Nectar show, or of a you know, Tycho show, or of something like that.
Yeah.
know, there are some people who say, oh, this is great. I want to get into the sounds and the frequencies. But the majority of the people are there and they're on, you know, this or that, and they're just dancing around and doing
and
whatever.
Wonderful. You know, and it's wonderful. And it should always keep on going. But it should not be explored only in the dance.
Right.
That's my point, is that if we do this, we'll be missing out a lot, especially that, you know, as human beings, we are really interested in music. I can safely say more than any other art. There's something in it that attracts us. And this is what I've been researching, why music is more popular than other art forms, visual arts, other performing arts, poetry, and so, dance, and so on. So it shouldn't only be limited to dancing. But yes, any rhythmic music is going to make any person, even a very old person who can barely walk, you see their foot starting to tap when they hear you know, something. There is an automatic response in us that would start to be triggered whenever we're hearing rhythm. Babies, old people, and you know, everyone responds to rhythm. And that's been exploited a lot.
Even people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
And it can be used therapeutically.
Absolutely.
And rhythms also can be used as a way to alter consciousness and have been used in a traditional sense. But then again, it shouldn't be limited to just rhythms, to just the rhythmic aspect and the dancing aspect of music to attract people, either to dance or to alter consciousness. There are other ways, and these other ways have been fully explored in ancient musical cultures, using just harmonies or melodies or various ratios or tone colors. So to zero in on electronic music, basically what happens in rhythmic music, and I don't mean to reduce it down, you know, to a simplistic practice or to take a reductionist approach, but most of the things that people hear happening in electronic music are, by the way, people hear me pluralizing music. That's totally correct in English and academia. People think that it's wrong. Okay, so what they hear when they're listening to electronic music, they're hearing various fluctuations of tempi, various use of tone colors, and different introductions of rhythms. And this is basically, these are the makings primarily of electronic music, and you can do so much with that. But there is also the skill of the producer in choosing and composing, layering and mixing and introducing vocals, let's say, sometimes acoustic instruments, and I'm really happy to see that more and more acoustic music is being amalgamated with electronic music, because that enriches the texture. And there's also something to say about, you know, acoustic music in general, because of the wide spectrum of overtones encompassed there. And that's still there, even if it's recorded, preferably if it's, you know, played acoustically and not recorded. Because, again, this is another can of worm that I don't want to open right now, basically addressing what we're missing when we listen to recorded music, especially recorded music with the lower sampling rate. And why an LP, you know, old-timers speak of the richness of an LP sound, a vinyl sound, versus a CD, or, you know, ripped music with low sampling rate. Basically, what we're missing out on is the wide spectrum of harmonic overtones. When you record any sound source, microphones, and people know that some microphones can go in thousands of dollars.
Oh, sure.
Microphones capture the amplitude, which is basically the softness and loudness of music. They capture the frequency, the highs and lows, but mostly the tone color. And this is why if you want to record drum set, you would use specific microphones, and the placement as well, where you place the microphone as a recording engineer has to be in the right spot. If you're recording vocals, you would use different mic. If you're recording pianos and so on. So there are different microphones that are built with specific sensitivity to specific harmonic overtone range. Why? Because the difference between your voice and my voice and Brian's voice and the voice and the sound of an oboe versus the sound of an acoustic guitar and so on, it's basically the overtone spectrum. Mm-hmm. There are various overtones that are absent or present. And if they're present, they're present to certain strength or weakness level. And that would constitute a tone color or timbre. And this is a very important aspect in human hearing that would allow us to differentiate one sound from another. And it's very important aspect to navigate as humans and knowing about what we're hearing without looking at it.
That's something that I was actually going to ask you, is how do we distinguish one person's voice from another?
So if I don't know you and I hear your voice and I don't know Jake, I will right away recognize that, well, they're two different people. But also if I know you and I hear your voice, let's say in a year and I've only heard your voice once, memory triggers that, oh, this is Brian's voice. And basically, why? Because your voice has very specific signature. If you were to analyze your voice using electronic equipment and specific software, you can see the spectrum of your voice. You can see the notes, which are harmonic overtones. You can see the signature, the map of what is, what's your voice going to look like if you're singing just one note. If you're singing a C note, we will see on that spectrum the C as a fundamental, and then we'll see specific overtones encompassed there. And if we were to compare your voice to my voice, Brian, we will find that my voice has different overtones that are pronounced to a certain level and some are absent. That will give my voice a specific timbre. It's written T-I-M-B-R-E. It's a French word that's used in English. Timbre, sometimes people say, well, it means tone color. So sound has a color. In the same way, specific fragrances, oils or incense would have a specific signature. And these are also notes. And this is a very complex system, intelligent system that encompasses mathematics. And we know that intelligence manifests in mathematics and nature, whether we're talking about Fibonacci numbers or fractal geometry and phi and pi and harmonic overtones is also another very complex system. And that's what I've been focusing on in my research, and how these overtones impact human consciousness. So when we're listening to specific sounds, we're hearing overtones. But most of the time, the fundamental frequency is more dominant than the overtones. It overshadows that, so we don't hear them. This is why when we hear a note played on a guitar or violin, we don't hear these other ghost-like tones. There are overtones that we tend to hear when we listen to Tibetan singing bowl, bell, didgeridoo, overtone singing, gong, because they're masked, overshadowed by the fundamental frequency. But in fact, all of them are there.
So I just wanted to field a question from a viewer, actually. What are your thoughts on music in political movements? And I know that we're taking a radical shift, but I did want to take one listener question, and that's, you know, because, okay, like you had Creedence Clearwater Revival, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, and I used this on our last episode too, where they said, you know, I ain't no senator's son, you know, and they're talking about going off to the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff. And yeah. You know, the Rolling Stones wrote songs about the war, and you know, the Beatles were, you know, and all these different
Bob
people,
Dylan, right?
Yeah. Bob Dylan, all these different people writing songs about the war. Mm-hmm. And then you go back even further into cultures, and you know, you hear. You know, the battle marches, and you hear the music of the, you know, of the colonial armies that used to march, and things like that. And so how does music affect political movements, governments, I mean, you know, armies, things like that? Mm-hmm. You know, what is that relationship like?
Very complex.
Okay. Very complex. Good. So we've got a good.
And this is also another thing that I can talk about for a long time. So, basically, it's not an accident that music is so powerful and so popular and so versatile. We know that music has always been used in shamanism and holistic practices and meditation as a way to get in touch with the spirits, the ancestors, you know, so on and so forth. And this is why religions used it very effectively and tamed it, have been interested in taming it and limiting it and putting the cap on it. And so did governments. But also military used music in the past. Some of the first military to have used music is actually the Ottoman, during the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire that lasted several centuries and occupied one third of the civilized world. They had special guards and kind of like commandos. They're called the Janissary. And they had mm-hmm. army bands. And the army bands...
Is this before or after the fall of Constantinople, just to give everybody a reference point? Or is this all during?
Before, during, and they continued. And army bands actually came from that. Or let's say we're influenced by that. I'm not saying that the Janissaries were the first to use music to support army in battles. No, they were the first to effectively explore it. So army bands marched in battles to support the troops and to... you know, uplift the morale of the soldiers playing specific tunes that are familiar. Why? To modify their consciousness, to boost their morale. And music has always been used to do various things, to tame people or to cause a rebellion. And this is why... you know, governments have been interested in limiting the power of music or to use it. And another thing that I've been focusing on is how music has been modified, and I think my humble opinion has been castrated, because the equal temperament, this is another complex thing that we can talk about for a long time, but the audience should know about it, that music in the West follows the equal temperament. The equal temperament, as you see, that there are a lot of cans of worms that are unavoidable, so I'm not going to explore it for all, but I just want to mention what the equal temperament is about. Equal temperament is basically the act of dividing the octave into 12 equidistant half steps. And early talk started around, well, in late 1500s, basically, which gave us some advantages, the ability to transpose pieces of music that are in a specific key signature to another key. Before the equal temperament, you couldn't transpose a piece of music, say, written in the key of C major to another distant key, whether going into the flats or sharps, because those of you who have studied music know that key signatures have symbols, basically. Mm-hmm. Next to the treble or bass clef, you would find a certain number of flats or sharps that would indicate that you're playing a key signature. So before that, you couldn't go into a distant key signature anywhere beyond four flats or four sharps because the piece of music would start to sound different. The equal temperament gave us the ability to transpose a piece of music from one key to any other key, neighboring or distant. But at the same time, it came at a cost. The cost is basically changing the mathematics of the octave. When you divide the octave into 12 equidistant half steps, and for those of you who don't know what a half step is, a half step is the distance between white and the adjacent black key on a piano. And it's the smallest division of sound in the West. In other musical cultures, we can find much smaller divisions of sound that we call microtones or quarter tones. So when you play a piece of music on non-equal tempered scale, you're working with the mathematics that nature gave us. When you observe the tuning of these harmonics that are in the harmonic overtone series, and by the way, this is the harmonic overtone series is something that physicists and mathematicians take much more seriously than musicians because it's a very complex system. People should look up the harmonic overtones. They're called harmonic overtones, but sometimes you may find them as the harmonic series or overtone series. Sometimes, you know, these terms are used interchangeably. So they have specific tuning. These overtones very often have different integer numbers that can be plus or minus and often fluctuating drastically, which means that they're not in tune with the perfectly tuned keyboard. This is the system that affects us. So when you're playing a gong or a Tibetan bowl and these overtones are being emitted and your consciousness is being subjected to these overtones through the complex hearing system and the complexity of the auditory cortex, your entire being, your cells, your energy, your neurochemistry, your brainwave cycles, everything that constitutes you, including the invisible part of us, is being affected by the sound. And if you're playing music in non-equal temperament or playing an instrument that has pronounced overtones, you're being affected by the natural mathematics. When you're being subjected to a piece of music that's built in equal temperament or using equal tempered instruments, such as the piano, guitar, any instrument that has frets or divisions, whether mallet instruments, vibraphone, marimba, xylophone, all keyboard instruments, harpsichords, organ, pianos, and fretted string instruments, guitars, bass guitars, so on, you're dealing with equal temperament because you cannot go smaller than the half step. But if you're playing fretless instruments such as violin, viola, cello, basses, or wind instruments as well, brass instruments, because you can overblow or underblow, you can affect the intonation on wind or brass instrument if you're skilled, and you can do it in style to produce this microtonality. It's another story. So it's very important to include the equal temperament into this discussion because this is where the magic is. So our music in the West, and this is where I wanted to end on, is tamed, mm-hmm. is limited.
Now, you talked about microtonals, and that's mainly found in Eastern music, is it not? You know, or where it's still alive presently today. Is more in the East. The Coptics, I believe, use microtonal chants. Places like the Middle East, you know, various countries in the Middle East, Asia, so on. And I know that we had talked a little bit about this in our last episode, but why did they not? Why did the sort of Greek Far East not lose their microtonal language? Why did the Byzantines not abandon that? Why did the Turks not abandon that? Why did the, I guess it would be the Sassanids or whoever was in power at the time? Why did they not abandon that? But the people, but let's say the people who lived in the kingdom of Francia or, you know, Northumbria or something like that, they said, ah, well, we can just get rid of this now?
This is an excellent question. And,
and the Greek East versus the Latin West, what happened?
Yes. Well, why? I can talk a lot about this. So, well, first, it's easier to address why did they use microtonality? Mm-hmm. Because it's more natural for us to respond to microtonality because that system is encoded in us. Violinist or any instrumentalist who plays a fretless instrument, they play in non-equal temperament. String musicians know that when they're playing with a fixed pitch instrument, let's say they're performing with a pianist, they have to adjust their intonation when they're playing with a pianist or guitar player, mm-hmm. because the pianist, that pianist or guitarist is limited with their intonation, so they would adjust it. So it's natural for us when we sing or when we play an instrument, assuming that instrument accommodates microtonality, to play in the system that nature gave us because we are part of nature. Having said that, it's also natural to say that we are affected by this microtonality. So the ancient musical cultures that we still find till this day that have preserved this microtonality, they use microtones. If you look at Turkish music, mostly classical music, Arabic, Persian, Indian, let's address the first three that I mentioned because they include microtones. So these musical cultures have half sharps, have half flats. This is something that does not exist in the Western world. For those of you who are not familiar with musical terminology, a flat lowers the tone by half a step. A sharp raises a tone by half a step. So when you have a quarter flat, or half flat, I meant to say, you're lowering the tone by approximately a quarter tone. This doesn't exist in the West. Where did they come from? Well, it's an ancient system. We really don't know how humans started exploring microtonality, but came out of the natural environment, natural need to compose and invent and build musical systems that are based on what we want, what our needs are, what affects human consciousness. And these musical systems have preserved microtonality. If you're talking about Indian classical music, well, in Indian classical music, the smallest step is a half step, like in the West, but the ratios are different. The half step that they have and the whole step, they're not the same width. They're not the same ratios. The half step in the West right now is equal to 100 cents. A cent is generally agreed on as the smallest division of sound. The octave is 1,200 cents. And the half step is 100. So right now, our half steps in the West are equidistant, so each one is 100. But if you're performing on similar system in Indian music, but where their half steps and whole steps are not the same width, you're still dealing with a level of microtonality. So ultimately, the reason why they did it, because they want to get the most out of sound, the most out of music, the most out of the musical system to affect human emotions and human consciousness and the physical body, all aspects of human. The emotional, energetic, intellectual, emotional, and so on and so forth. We in the West disconnected from that for practicality, but who knows? Maybe they had a bigger agenda, which is basically to limit the power of music, to not allow altered states to be resulted. And we know so much about how the reaction was when rock and roll came about, right?
Oh, right, absolutely.
So I can state many examples like that. And also how the music of the African slaves during slavery time was banned, basically. They would not allow them in New Orleans, that is. They would not allow them to play their drums during ceremonies because they felt that maybe they're communicating messages or worshiping their gods or, you know, doing some voodoo stuff on the colonizers. I mean, ridiculous things. But at the end, music has been used as a tool for controlling people. And right now, music is sound is used in military application. There's a great book about this as well. So music is a very versatile tool. Not that can be used for good and for bad. And maybe at some point in the future, we're going to find out that sound is really the ultimate medicine, as many people have said that, you know, including Edgar Cayce, that sound is the medicine of the future. Not where we're at right now. If you go on YouTube, you find a lot of things. Oh, this is the frequency of this. This is the frequency of that. No, we need a lot more research. Things are not quantified to make such assumptions. People are passionate, and that's great. But it's not correct to let this passion that we have to start making big assumptions, to start propagating wishful thinking and unconfirmed rumors. Whether you're talking about the solfeggio frequencies or not, we still need to do a lot more research. But it's a catch-22 at the same time, because we really don't have the science to explore and scrutinize music on the level we'd like to.
You mentioned the military, and there is one project, I don't know if you're familiar with, that I think is important to point out. And that's that there were a lot of beached whales that were bleeding out of their ears or something like that, or what they considered their ears. And they believed that it was due to military sonar, to weapons testing. And that these whales could not handle that it was messing with their, I guess, brains, and they basically beached themselves and died, and then they were bleeding out of their ears.
It's feasible. I've read a lot about that. Some are extra low frequencies, ELF, and sonar. Yeah, it is quite feasible, especially that we know that how sophisticated the auditory system is for whales and how much they're capable of communicating through hundreds and hundreds of miles with each other. And it's important to mention also that sound travels in liquids four times more efficiently than air. So you can transmit sonic message or sound or music in water a lot more efficiently than air, and this is why whales, dolphins, and other fish and mammals are able to communicate via large distances. So yeah, it is feasible that is the result. I mean, we can't be sure yet. There are a lot of crazy things happening with new military applications, and most of it is unknown. So what's happening with HARP and how effective HARP is, and the experiments with ELF and so on.
You just mentioned the HARP experiment. Is that a sound experiment or is that a weather experiment?
It's weather, but it's also experiment with ionized particles and projecting these particles into the ionosphere. And this is basically something that came out of Tesla's experiments. That's another topic. We're not going to start talking about this. As it is, the conversation is so wonderful and complex. So, I mean, sound is explored a lot in military and in science as well. But it's very important for scientists who are working on consciousness to look more into sound and not just in, you know, compounds and other stimuli and tools, because what I'm finding in my research, and this is not going to be news to a lot of the listeners, the sound has always been used as a tool to alter consciousness. Look, for example, in holistic practices and in Eastern philosophy, how much and to what extent mantras and sutras have been used, or specific musical instruments such as gongs and various bells and discs. Tibetan singing bowls are among them, have been used to induce a deeper state of meditation, to alter consciousness. Now, shamans throughout the world used plants, but they also use sound in conjunction with that.
Oh, yes.
Because they figured out that the Icaros and drumming beats and tempos and various things, chants and didgeridoos and all sorts of instruments. I'm not going to name all of them, but generally, you know, the instruments that have been used a lot are percussion instruments, drums, and shakers and rattles, and the voice, of course, and didgeridoos and wind instruments and so on. So this combination is magical, and sound has always been very essential element in any shamanic experience, and it's not just the plant teachers. But in Asia, where this ancient science of metallurgy and metallurgy is a sophisticated chemistry, we really don't know where the knowledge of metallurgy came from, combining various metals to create specific instrument that would allow you to hear resonant frequency. The first instruments to have been made, generally agreed on, they're bells, basically. And bronze was used. And there's something that's called bell bronze. That means a high quality of bronze. And bronze is a mixture of copper and tin, mostly copper and tin, and various other elements to a smaller level. These bells that we find, gongs, Tibetan singing bowls, are approximately 77% copper, 22% tin, and mixture, small amounts, tiny amounts of other elements, iron, lead, mercury, silver, perhaps gold, but really less than 1%. And forging an instrument like this and hammering it to tighten the crystals, metals are crystals. Also, this may be news to some listeners, but really, they're crystals. And when you hammer these molecules to create a really tightly wound metal, that's going to be resonant. So when you hit a gong or a Tibetan bowl, you're going to have the resonant frequency come out, the fundamental and various overtones. But why did the ancients spend so much time, energy, ingenuity to construct these instruments? What did they get out of? Why are they still in use? Why are we obsessed now? Why are we experiencing this extreme rise in sound healing and attention to these instruments? Why are they mesmerizing? Why are they effective to induce a deeper altered state of consciousness? People in Asia constructed these instruments and did not primarily, mostly did not include plants. In some cases they did, in Bern, for example, which is an ancient shamanic tradition in the Himalayas. Most of Tibetan Buddhism is really Bern belief, and it's spelled B-O umlaut on O, the two dots, N, or Bon sometimes pronounced. And so there's an ancient shamanic culture that also used sound, but in ancient religions that are still around, in Taoism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Sikhism, we find extreme use of mantras and sutras and sometimes instruments, and they only use sound. So this tells me that sound can alter consciousness by itself without the inclusion of plants. Even better when you combine the two. And this is what shamans did. In Africa, they also sought after overtones. They constructed instruments made from plant material, but through various processes, they brought the overtones out of these mallet instruments such as the timbila and balafon and jil, And to bring out the buzzing, the overtones in it.
They use something also called a timbrel as well in many of the Eastern churches. Yeah. Many of the Eastern churches, like the Assyrian Orthodox Church of the East, they use the timbrel and the harp, they say.
Right, right. And also, I want to mention also one important instrument, the mbira. Mbira, it's spelled M-B-R-R-A. And the djil is spelled G-Y-I-L. Timbila, T-I-M-B-I-L-A. Balafon is another instrument. B-A-L-A-P-H-O-N-E sometimes. So basically, they would use these instruments to call the spirits. Mm-hmm. Well, when you hear these instruments, you hear overtones. So they associate the overtones with the ancestors, with the spirits. Are the spirits really accessible through the overtones? Mm-hmm. Are the spirits overtones? Or are the overtones inducing an altered state of consciousness, which take us to the spirit world? These are very important questions to ask. Now, that, going back to something that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and that brings you back.
Like, I want to ignore it, which is basically why in traditional chants and Byzantine chants, they include microtonality. Byzantine chants are the chants used in Byzantine music, which is the Eastern
Orthodox,
basically, Eastern Christianity. In Greek Orthodoxy, and they're mesmerizing chants. And
absolutely.
Because they've been influenced by Turkish and Arabic music. Constantinople was in, you know.
It was the gateway to the East.
Exactly. So, and they're amazingly mesmerizing. People should really listen to them. There are plenty of examples on the internet and on YouTube. And Ambrosian chants are very much influenced by Byzantine chants. So,
and actually, just to plug a studio here, there's actually a Scola in Milan. It's the Scola Gregoriana de Mediolanesis. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. In Milan, Italy, it's run by Giovanni Vianini. He's a fantastic organist, and he's a fantastic cantor. So if you guys want to find out more about Ambrosian chant, that's definitely one place to look is, and I believe it's mainly sung now in the Archdiocese of Milan and Venice. So,
Another important thing to mention about the organ, since you mentioned that, and since we were talking about overtones, people often wonder why there's so many pipes in church organ and cathedral organs. Well, each pipe is there to bring out certain partials. So partials are all of the notes included in any sound. That includes the fundamental and its overtones. And when you're talking about the fundamental and the other overtones, which go to infinity, basically, let's say you have you're playing a note, and that note is a C, and that would be the fundamental frequency. The first overtone to be in the harmonic series would be an octave higher C, 8 notes apart, or 12 half steps apart. And the next tone would be above from that, the second overtone or second harmonic would be a G, and the third one would be another C, and the intervals starting with an octave going into fifth, fourth, and third, they start to shrink and go to infinity. Now, when you're playing organs, and people probably know that these organs have various stops that the organist would pull out and need to modify sound to give you an oboe-like sound or violin-like sound and so on. They're basically modifications of the air flowing through the pipes to open or close various stops to give you a timbre that would be similar to that specific instrument. And this is why you would have these pipes ranging from very large to very small to design a tone color that would approximate the sound of it. Of that instrument. So, going back to what we were talking about, basically about microtonality and chants. So, these chants included microtonality, whether you know you're talking about Byzantine chants or Coptic chants, and so on. And not only in the religious realm, it's important also to mention that in the secular realm, they were also used. If you listen to Georgian vocal music, Georgian from Georgia, the country, not the state, or Corsican chants as well, they're incredibly complex. And Georgian chants are also polyphonic. Mm-hmm. They're really, really complex. Stravinsky, the famous 20th century composer who wrote The Rite of Spring, probably the single most important composition in 20th century, was obsessed, was fascinated with Gregorian chant, because there we have a system that is sophisticatedly harmonic and polyphonic that is not considered academic and taught. It's also transmitted through oral tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where you have a very complex texture and complex harmonies and complex microtonalities that would leave the listener that, wow, is this contemporary? Is this traditional? Is this classical? Is this folkloric? You know, they're truly mesmerizing. So where did these systems come from? Well, we don't know. But if we, and as I'm starting to find, and the system is really innate in us, it's encoded in us. So naturally, when we explore artistry through human ingenuity, we're going to explore the natural system in us, assuming no one interferes
right.
and modifies the system. And we're going to bring out the sophisticated system that is in nature, this level of mathematics that is in nature, in the same way that the Fibonacci numbers are in the Nautilus shell and in the broccoli and in the sunflower. They are in our fingers and hand and ratios in all of the entire body, and probably in our neurons and everything that constitute the human body. So this is why humans have explored them in the religious context or the secular or in the spiritual. And if you leave them out of the education system, then naturally people are not going to explore them because they're not aware of their existence. But then if you let people explore things more and more, then people are going to start to construct the system in the same way that electronic music right now is being performed. And we know how far the DJ came along from the 70s. The DJ was the guy spinning records in a nightclub. And now the DJ is the center of the attention, is the performer, is the band elevated on stage with spotlights on and people dancing and facing him or her. And the DJ can see the people because the lights are always on and wants to see how people are being affected. And if the DJ is really sensitive, and most famous DJs are really, and they're really attuned to what people are feeling and how they're moving, they make extemporaneous adjustments. They change that set that they had planned in mind. They follow the energy. They tweak things to take people further and further into where they want to go. This is an old system. This is an ancient system that has been around for a long time. We're not creating something new. We're recreating it in a different setting, under different conditions. I can tell you about one setting that has been around for who knows for how long, which is basically found in the Arab world and in Turkish music. And, you know, this is something that's sound and that is agreed on, but I'm not saying that it exists only there, but it exists there with high level of awareness. For example, in a classical Arabic music performance, you have a band, whether group of vocalists, instrumentalists, or combination of both, and an audience. The ultimate point of any performance in classical Arabic music is for the performers to perform using their sensitivity, their technical abilities, their feeling, to reach the audience. But there's one requirement here, that the audience have to be attuned, have to be listening. And there's an art of listening. And when we start to study ancient musical cultures, in the same way we find in jazz performances and other musical styles, that, and, you know, I can generalize a bit that, you know, more and more audiences are becoming more and more sophisticated and aware, even in a rock concert, that they listen with an attunement, they listen with intention. But this can be taken much further to a level where you have a connoisseur of jazz in a jazz club really listening and paying attention and shutting people around if anyone is talking, you know, because they want to focus on what's being communicated. This is also an ancient art, and this is what I was going to talk about. The art of tarab, basically, is a high level of euphoria, of ecstasy, of enchantment achieved through musical playing and musical listening, where these judicious listeners present in the audience are listening with scrutinizing ears, with awareness, with knowledge. And they don't need to be musicians, and many of them are not. They're just connoisseurs and aficionados, and they know a lot of things that's happening in music. What the maqam or mode, or similar to a scale, that is being utilized, how the musician is improvising and bringing out the ethos, the quality, the character, the personality of the mode. And I can probably talk about mode, the difference between mode and scale later.
We're getting a little short on the program, so
yeah.
Just letting you
know.
So
they bring out all the properties that can be communicated in music, and they're also uttering phrases and words, stock of words and phrases, communicating attunement and enjoyment in the same way that you would find them in Indian music performance, whether throwing words or making a head gesture or hand gesture, communicating to the performers that we're listening, and they comment on not only clearly virtuosic passages, but very subtle and technical things. And this communicates to the performers that, wow, they're with us. They're really listening. And ultimately, they both parties reach a high level of attunement, of enjoyment, altered state of consciousness through conscious construction of very tight dynamics, where this boundary between an audience and a performer would cease to exist. And they can both affect each other through each other's presence, participation, whether in a participatory listening or sensitive, dedicated playing, sensitive to what's happening in the audience. And this is basically what happens in electronic music performance, while people are dancing, watching, and losing themselves in the concert, and the DJ for performer, you know, sometimes we don't often call these people DJs; they're really performer and composers or producers. You know, it's all, you know, this is where you have a nebulosity of the terminology. So that means we're really going into another level of interaction here, and they're with the audience, and they're sacrificing everything to keep the audience going and taking themselves to that high
level,
unattainable level.
And having been in a band, those intangibles, that dynamic, it didn't always happen at every show, but when it did, I just felt it.
You know it's there.
Those dynamics, which are very novel, they're not often experienced.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our program today, and I want to make sure that everybody knows about soundmeditation.com. So, Alexandria, why don't you tell us a little bit about your website and what kind of resources are on there, and where else we could find some of your work?
Sure. Actually, this website is fairly recent. I've been doing the research for a long time, but I've been focusing primarily on doing the research and working with people, offering the sound meditation to people, and also communicating this important knowledge about sound and the various aspects involved in it, because I really feel that this knowledge belongs to people, and it's not something that can easily be accessed. And this is why I have not published, written. I'm actually writing something that will eventually become a book, and starting to record. I've recorded some stuff and they're being edited. So I've been uploading and putting material on the website. Mm-hmm. They'll find a lot of information about the sound meditation, its elements, and also some events that I'm doing, conferences and talks that I've given, videos to watch. Nothing is available for purchase. Unfortunately, I give very little attention to that, but I should contribute. But it's, you know, it gets in the way sometimes in the way of doing the research and working with people. I tend to prefer more on the latter than on doing the commercial things, which are important to keep the research going, because I've been financing it myself and I spend a lot of money on it. And it's an independent research, but people can get in touch with me, can get information about it. It's basically at this point, it's an open source. Take it, see what you can do with it. Use sound, buy bowls, meditate with sound, and be open to music. That's something that's very, very important. It's easy to get so attached to the music that we listen to the style, to the genre, to the performer or the band. But really don't limit yourself to that and be open, because curiosity, openness, is the most important element to expand our consciousness and learn. We all need to be philosophers, and philosophers, you know, is love of knowledge. And when we miss out on learning something new, we miss out on a lot. And that which we don't know is really not there. So it's important to know that things are there and to research things and not to take words of so-and-so for granted, that this frequency is for that, this binaural beat is going to do this or that. You know, we need a lot more research, and everybody should be involved.
I agree.
People should become more educated as listeners, and they have been becoming, but we need to become more so, because sound and music is an infinite knowledge and very, if not the most versatile too.
So yeah, and I agree, and this is a great thing, and I encourage everybody. Again, the website is soundmeditation.com. www.son or S-O-U-N-D. Wow, I even spelled it wrong. Excuse me. SOUNDMEDITATION.com. Soundmeditation.com. Make sure you go there, bookmark it, save it, check it out, look at some of the material, and it'll help you get a broader understanding of what we talked about here today, and of course introduce you to Alexandre's fantastic work, which I've been following for a while now and is really good. Really good
Thank
stuff.
You.
Really good
Thank
stuff.
You.
So
happy to share it. It's very exciting. And my point is to get people really enthusiastic and passionate and excited. But
I'm a Baroque music freak. So so you've already got me hooked anyway.
I'm all music freak.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, so, yeah, I yeah, guess you could say the same.
Jake got me listening to some monastic chants the other day in my headphones while I was sitting at the cafe. So
yeah, Ambrosian and Gregorian chant. The two of those are just beautiful. But thank you so much for coming on today. Just stay with us as we wrap up the program.
My pleasure.
So, Brian, any final comments for today?
Final comments,
thoughts, words.
I just encourage everybody to check out Alexandre's, sound meditation and his lecture, because he's going to be giving his lecture.
Oh yes,
prior to the sound meditation, and you know, he's going to be providing context, which is really important. So yeah, if you're interested in this, check out the website symposia.com with a P. And anybody that's not in the Amherst area or not in New England can watch it live. It's $10.
Yeah, it's
on the website.
God, I can't spell anything today.
It's okay, Jake.
PSYMPOSIA. It's because my glasses, I and people don't believe me. I actually need my glasses adjusted. Symposium is in Amherst, like Brian had said, on the 12th and the 13th. the live stream is available. You can go to the website, pre-order the live stream. It's great. If you can't make it out, and let's say you live in, I don't know, France, the Netherlands,
no, it's
England,
great. We have people all are. Over. We have about 16 countries now far, which I'm actually really pleased with. So this is going to be
let's make it 50.
Cool. Yeah, you know? Let's make it 50.
So if you're out there and you're in one of these countries and you want to,
we need some people from South America.
Yeah,
from Africa.
We need
in
some
the Middle East
the,
right now.
Yep, that, that's where we need
those three areas. We don't have anybody. So if you're out there. Let's fill in the map.
Exactly. So, and of course, here at Dose Nation, you can find us at dosenation.com. If you want to look us up on Facebook, Twitter, or SoundCloud, it's /DoseNation. I'm not going to go through the Facebook.com. For, I mean, it's same thing all the way through. Just do.
Everybody has Google.
Yeah, everybody has Google. so it's just /DoseNation. Whether it's Twitter, SoundCloud, or Facebook, but then it changes for our YouTube account, which is Dose Nation TV or Dose Nation Video. Dose Nation Video. It's at Dose Nation Video, and that's where you can find. There's some stuff on there about actually some chants and about my stay at the Abbey and my participation in the monastic way. So definitely do that, and of course, so we have a donation button. And please donate to Symposia as well if you can, and purchase. You know, different things, and check out www.soundmeditation.com. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. I'm your host, Jake Kettle, here with you as always, and with me now, and hopefully for a while, Brian Norman. Brian, thank you so much for being with us as always. And
you're welcome.
Alexandre,
thanks, guys.
Of course. So.
Thank you. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for inviting me.
Everybody who's listening live, thank you for coming in, and we will see you all next time. Thank you all. Have a good morning, good afternoon, and or good evening wherever you are in the world. Stay safe and stay happy if you can. So thanks and have a good one.